At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. 5,593 pages, $2.3 trillion. Gosh, I wonder what's in it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 21st day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Just to be clear, there are two things going on with this $2.3 trillion package Congress is working its way through in the fading hours of this year. $1.4 trillion to fund the government through next September and $900 billion in pandemic economic relief. It looks like, and one stresses looks like, because you never know, but it looks like the thing is going to pass, and we're going to talk about what's in it through the program today. But over the weekend, there were some hiccups, the biggest of which centered on the Federal Reserve and what it will and won't be allowed to do. Gina Smilek covers the Fed for the New York Times. Also, she is a regular here on Fridays. Hey, Gina.
Hey, Kai.
So in layperson's terms here, if I might, what was the hang up with the Fed and Senator Toomey and the Fed's authorities?
So basically, the Fed did a couple of emergency lending programs in this crisis that it has never tried before. It bought corporate bonds, it bought municipal bonds, and it lent directly to small and mid-sized businesses via banks. And so all of those programs were real sort of departures from what we've seen in the past. And Senator Toomey wanted to make sure that they couldn't happen again. He said that, you know, Congress had intended for them to only last through 2021. And so he inserted language into this bill that would have basically prohibited them or anything similar to them from ever happening in the future without Congress's approval.
And the compromise was what?
The compromise is that we made that word similar same. Which sounds pretty simple, right?
It does not sound
like a big deal. But it was a big deal because I think the way that similar could have been interpreted is to mean that basically any sort of credit-like program would be impossible in the future. The way Democrats are painting the word same means that specifically these exact programs set up precisely the way that these ones were set up cannot just be restarted once, you know, the next Treasury Secretary, presumably Janet Yellen, who's likely to be the nominee for that job, is in place next year. And so the idea is you can't have this immediate copycat, but you could potentially do something that looks a little bit like this way down the road if there's another financial crisis.
Well, that's my next question, right? This is really about the crisis next time, because there is another one coming, as we know.
Right. And I think it's worth noting that some of these markets that the Fed intervened in this time, the municipal bond market, I think being a good example, they were melting down in March. You know, the Fed stepped in and got them to work again. But there was a moment there where it was looking pretty dicey in corporate bonds and municipal bonds. And so the idea that this legislation would just take away all of those powers, I think could definitely, you know, raise some concerns among people, certainly who work in markets, but I think also people who are concerned about, you know, who has crisis fighting power, who saves us first.
Yeah. How much of what was going on here was about Fed independence and its ability to do what it sees is right? I note that Chair Powell has not said a word. We had Rob Kaplan from Dallas on Friday, and he ducked my question on it. Chair Bernanke actually said something over the weekend, right?
Right. I think the Fed has been caught in some political crossfire here. And what I mean by that is Democrats have kind of been eyeing these facilities that the Fed set up this time and thinking about how they could enhance them to make them more generous once they're in office. And so the idea is you could potentially use things like the municipal program to really funnel cheap money to states and localities. Now, the problem, as all of your listeners will be aware, is that Democrats tend to be much more concerned about those constituents than Republicans are. And so the idea is the Fed could be used for political means. And that's why Senator Toomey was really concerned about the future of these programs. I think the Fed basically wants to stay out of the political conversation here. The important nuance that gets missed is they would have had to agree to that sweetening up of the municipal facility. But yeah, so they got caught in the crossfire a little. Ben Bernanke weighed in to say, hey, don't take away powers the Fed used to have and that it needs. But even his statement was done in very apolitical terms, I think.
Yeah, very, very Bernanke-like terms. Gina Smilek, she covers the Fed for the New York Times and here every now and then on a Friday. Gina, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Talk to you soon. Wall Street on this Monday of a short week, a little subdued, actually, by the virus news, relief bill or not. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, what else is in this thing? There is some help in this relief bill for the estimated 14 million households that are behind on their rent. An extension of a national eviction moratorium by a month gets them to the end of January, which is not a lot of time. The deal also includes $25 billion in emergency rental assistance. Getting that money to the people who need it, though, is a whole nother challenge because, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, millions of dollars in rental assistance from the original CARES Act still hasn't been spent, and it is not for lack of demand, believe you me.
Tyler Walters is the kind of person rental relief was supposed to help. He has chronic bronchitis and, as a restaurant server, hasn't felt safe working more than a few shifts a week. He applied to a state program during the summer, got rejected, he applied again, then got approved earlier this month.
I was, like, joking about how I wanted to frame the thing when they sent it to me. I was like, oh, this is, like, life-changing.
$2,500 went directly to his landlord and covered 2.5 months' rent. But as much as $335 million of the rental assistance Walters tapped could remain unspent by the end of the year. That's according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Andrew Orend is the group's vice president for research. He says while some state and local programs exhausted their funds quickly, others have been hung up by administrative delays.
And so what these programs really needed was more time. And we were really fearful that that time was going to run out.
Washington looks likely to extend the original December 30th deadline to spend that money to the end of next year. But in Pennsylvania, time has already run out after the legislature imposed a November 30th deadline. Many landlords there weren't crazy about the program until the state eased limits on how much rent they could collect. That led to a surge in applications, says Bryce Moretzky, director of policy and planning at the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency.
I think that last month showed what a successful program sort of from the beginning probably would have looked like.
Still, the state only managed to give out about a third of its available funding. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Access to capital in this economy, and with it mobility and opportunity, are most definitely not evenly distributed. The challenge is getting the word out about what that lack of access to capital looks like. That brings us to the Pine Ridge Reservation in the southwest corner of South Dakota, almost 3,500 square miles, home to 20,000 people, but really only one option for business loans there, an organization called Lakota Funds. Tawny Brunch is the executive director. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about the businesses to which you lend. What lines of work are they in?
So we don't have a lot of businesses on Pine Ridge. You drive through each of the nine districts, and you're not going to see your typical main streets, you know, with curbs and gutters and storefronts and all of that. Our businesses are sometimes mechanics operating out of their own garage. Mm. We have a lot of quilt makers, for instance, where I've walked into some of our clients' homes, and they've dedicated most of their house to the quilting machines and stuff. But currently, Lakota Fund's portfolio is made of primarily ag producers.
You grew up on Pine Ridge, right?
I grew up 12 miles south of the Badlands, south of wow. Interior South Dakota. Wow. And so, yes, this is home. Actually, it feels like I've come full circle. Because growing up here, my grandma Puyer, Isabel Puyer, actually owned the business, Bell's Diner and Laundromat, right across the street from where my office is currently.
Huh.
So it felt good, like the universe had directed me back home.
I bet. Tell me about your grandma, though. I mean, I can't imagine however many years ago that was. It's got to be 50, 60 years ago, trying to get a business running on Pine Ridge.
Absolutely. And so my grandma, and that's some of my fondest memories of her, honestly. She started with the laundromat, and pretty soon she's making, you know, her homemade caramel rolls. Those became so popular that she converted the whole space to be a cafe. She had to live at the back of her store to make that mm-hmm. business work. And that's what she did.
Your grandma winds up businesswoman. How do you wind up in banking? Did you leave the reservation? Did you leave Pine Ridge and then come back?
I did. So where we grew up was about equal distance from about three different high schools. And some of those were on reservation. Some of them were off. The decision that my parents made to send me to school off reservation really changed my whole life. I went to South Dakota State University and got my degree in commercial economics. Because I wanted to be like the movie Wall Street. I'm giving away my age here. But the movie Wall Street was yes. huge in the day. I wanted to be like working, you know, on the New York Stock Exchange. I wanted to be a stockbroker. So wow. I went to school to be a commercial in commercial economics. There became a position available in Wall for a branch manager for Black Hills Federal Credit Union. And I applied and, of course, got the job and was at Black Hills Federal for 8 years before I started at Lakota Funds.
So let's be clear here. You didn't want to be Gordon Gekko. You didn't want to do that whole greed is good
right,
thing.
But, right?
But look, let me ask you. The reason I asked you about yourself is so I could ask you this question, which is young people today, when they leave Pine Ridge, do they come back? Because that's the economic future, right?
Absolutely. And I think kind of we can't get away from Pine Ridge because this is home and there's no place else like it. It's hard to leave, but a lot of times, even if these kids, you know, go to school somewhere, it's hard for them to finish out and get their four-year degree. Sometimes they do leave and never come back because they don't see the economic opportunity here. And I just feel like that it should be completely opposite from that. We need every type of business on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Start your own business. Come back to Pine Ridge and start your own and then employ as many people as you want. But it takes a while before, you know, people see that opportunity. I think it takes some time in us delivering that message.
Yeah. Tawny Brunch is the executive director of Lakota Funds. We got her on the Pine Ridge Reservation out in Kyle, South Dakota. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kai.
Coming up.
Yesterday online, I bought a Dr. Fauci Christmas ornament.
Hint, hint, if my family is listening. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 37 points today, about a 10%, 30,216. The NASDAQ down 13 points, a 10%, 12,742. The S&P 500 off 14 points, almost 0.4%, 36.94. Got to tell you, it was way worse early on in this session. Travel stocks, in fact, did take a hit in that new strain of the virus news out of the UK. United Airlines down 1.5%. American Airlines gave back 2.4%. Royal Caribbean, or Caribbean, I get it wrong every single time they run the cruises, down 0.6%. Nike up 4.9% today on better than expected earnings in the fiscal second quarter. Under Armour softened about a 0.1%, though. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.93%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com. This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Of the $900 billion in coronavirus relief that Congress is hustling to get out the door today, $15 billion is set aside for concert venues, cultural institutions, that's museums and the like, and independent movie theaters. As we have been telling you, low these many months, small movie theaters in this economy have barely been hanging on during this pandemic. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looked at what the future might hold for them.
In October, when New York State allowed theaters in certain places to reopen, Cinemopolis, a small independent theater in Ithaca, New York, didn't do it. Executive Director Brett Bozzard says it didn't feel right.
We really didn't want to be the one movie theater in a pretty large radius to be open and be potentially an attractor for the virus into our community.
The theater got a PPP loan in April, but that's gone now. With the help of its savings and some donations, Cinemopolis has been continuing to pay its 12 employees. But Bozzard just did the 2021 budget, and
we are going to need some additional support to operate in any capacity for the coming year.
Because even when the theater does reopen, it'll be limited by the state to 25% capacity. And it won't have many movies to show. Cinemopolis shows a lot of indie films, but it relies on crossover hits from studios, like last year's Parasite or Little Women, to bring people in. And because so many theaters are closed, studios have been delaying their movie releases.
One thing that we were waiting on this fall was the new Wes Anderson film. That's just been sort of mothballed, I think, indefinitely until more markets are open.
Sean Robbins, chief analyst at BoxOfficePro.com, says that's one of the reasons that despite the vaccine, theaters need the money now.
We still have a very rough winter to get through. And exhibitors don't really have a lot of new product coming out until March.
This is coming off a year of dismal attendance. According to the National Association of Theater Owners, movie theaters have collected only about 10% of the ticket sales during the pandemic that they did in the same period last year. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Five words, gang. David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. Check them out. President-elect Biden got his corona vaccine today. He'll get the booster before Inauguration Day, so he'll be covered once he's officially on duty. Healthcare workers and residents of nursing homes have started to get theirs, and a CDC advisory panel has made its recommendations about who ought to be next. People who staff food and agriculture supply chains, firefighters and law enforcement, also teachers. But there is some disagreement about how fast educators should be fast-tracked. Remote learning, while imperfect, means teachers don't have to be in the classroom, and there are some questions about how risky it actually might be to be in a room full of kids. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
States will have the final say about when teachers get vaccinated. Utah, for example, is already planning to vaccinate all educators in January. But teachers may not be considered essential frontline workers under some state guidelines, says labor economist Francine Blau.
These categories are nuanced. So we have to consider, is remote education a possibility? What are the downsides to remote education for the students themselves, but also for their families?
Blau, who's at Cornell, has studied frontline workers. She says teachers may not be as at risk as, say, meatpacking staff. They can work from home. Many have been for months. But that's brought other complications, says health policy professor Lisa Prosser. She's at the University of Michigan.
We are especially concerned about disruptions in in-person schooling, that there may be very long-term effects, especially in these vulnerable communities.
Prosser says remote school has amplified existing economic disparities and made it hard for many parents, especially women, to work. But simply vaccinating teachers may not automatically make schools safe, says Harley Litzelman. He's a high school teacher in Oakland, California.
If there's uncontrolled spread in a community, there's going to be something similar in schools.
While kids are at lower risk of severe disease, they have been found to spread the virus, and current vaccines have only been authorized for adults. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Time, I believe, is probably up or close to it if you're ordering something online and hoping to have it here by Friday. Thursday night, really, right? And as we know, this has been quite the year for online shopping, which means it has also been quite the year for shipping. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the pandemic shipping desk today.
You know, a lot of people really had high hopes for 2020.
I was hoping that, you know, I would take some time during the summer, travel with some friends.
Yes, I was supposed to be in Japan.
I had a whole trip to Andalusia planned.
Jesse Ng in Minneapolis, Ken Staffy in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Chris Banks in Houston. You know what they did instead? They shopped online.
Yesterday online, I bought a Dr. Fauci Christmas ornament.
Computer peripherals like keyboards and mice.
Like, I have so many sweaters now, even though I live in Texas and it's usually like 75 degrees in December.
Now, somebody has got to move that Dr. Fauci ornament from A to B. And this means it is a great time to be in the shipping business.
I'm a trucking company, but I'm a very small trucking company because it's just me and my truck.
Chad Boblett is a trucker in Lexington, Kentucky. According to shipping broker DAT, in November, there were 4.5 truckloads needing to be shipped for every truck out there. That is double what it was last year.
It doesn't matter who you are. If you got a truck and you're driving, there's somebody out there that's wanting to give you some money to do it.
And all across the country, that is exactly what's happening.
Yeah, freight rates are experiencing a surge like they have never experienced before right now.
Tim DeNoyer is a senior analyst at ACT Research.
Rates for the truckload spot market are currently up 40 to 50% over a year ago.
Truckload spot market basically just means last minute delivery. And rates have been skyrocketing for months. They've been setting records since July. Part of what is going on here is, well, a ton of businesses just needed to re-up their supplies.
There was a big destocking in inventory at sort of at the beginning of the pandemic. And so there's been this, you know, significant need for restocking at the retail level.
But there's also something more complicated going on. It's not just that we are suddenly buying Dr. Fauci Christmas ornaments. It's that the pandemic has thrown the entire shipping system out of whack. Because despite all the computer keyboards and furniture and God knows what else we are buying for our homes, overall freight is down. Dean Croak is market analyst at DAT.
We haven't had catering. Restaurants, their volumes have eroded away 90%. Our colleges, all those sorts of areas that take huge volumes of food have been down.
So some shipping has gone nuts. Some shipping is just not happening. And that's messing with the market.
As the pandemic rages and a city goes into lockdown, consumption increases, but production decreases. And that means that there's more loads going in and less coming out and more empty miles for trucks. And you get this imbalance.
Shippers have to cover costs for the miles where they carry a lot of stuff and the miles back where maybe they carry nothing. And refrigerated trucks bringing in food aren't right for bringing, say, sweaters. All of this disruption, Croak says, is still driving prices up, which, by the way, is not great for the businesses that need to ship stuff.
Obviously has an impact on the business.
Stu Landesberg is CEO of Grove Collaborative, which sells sustainable home and personal care products like concentrated detergent. It takes less room in trucks, but Landesberg says he's still had to eat the costs of higher shipping.
The price increases are painful, but I think a small cost to pay for the societal benefit of keeping so many folks safe.
But generally speaking, according to ACT Research, the increase in shipping charges is going to be an added strain on a lot of businesses well into 2021. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, our last word for now on the relief and government funding bill Congress is trying to get done. We direct your attention now to Division E, Title I of the bill, Department of the Treasury, Section 114, which reads in full, "None of the funds appropriated in this act or otherwise available to the Department of the Treasury or the Bureau of Engraving and Printing may be used to redesign the $1 Federal Reserve note." That, of course, is the official name of the $1 bill. I'm thinking that's the vending machine lobby at work here, right? Here is your Monday moment. Oh, economic context on the way out. Public Health Division. Y'all know how I like to check in on the TSA every now and then. How many people are passing through checkpoints compared to a year ago as a way to gauge the health of the airline industry? Here is just a check on health overall. Despite all those CDC travel warnings, the TSA says 3.2 million people got on airplanes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the biggest weekend of this pandemic so far, I guess you have to say. Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios are the daily production team around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.